very warm welcome, everyone, to the Alethea Foundation's first in a series of podcasts that seek to address the urgent energy topics of the day with a number of invited expert speakers. My name is Axel Threlfall. I'm editor-at-large at Reuters, and I am delighted to be hosting this first in the podcast series. Now, as I'm sure many of you are aware, the Alethea Foundation is an independent think tank that aims to provide robust and practical knowledge and insight on global energy and sustainable development topics, and of course, communicate those for the benefit of the Foundation's members and community. Before I introduce our guest, let me quickly bring you up to speed with the very latest news, courtesy of Reuters. Another pretty torrid day for oil prices. No surprises why. Concerns over storage capacity, as well as fears of a slow pickup in post-lockdown demand, both weighing on sentiment. WTI futures hitting a low at $10.07 Tuesday after another big sell-off on Monday. Brent futures down to as low as 18.73. Now, part of that WTI drop due to retail investment vehicles like ETFs selling out of the front month June contract and buying into later months, the US oil fund, the most high profile to do just that. Separately, LNG prices also still under pressure. Spot prices for North Asia deliveries fell to $1.95 last week, the first ever sub $2 close. US natural gas closed last week at $1.75. Above recent lows, but well below its peak at 291 back in November. So that is a little bit of context. Let me introduce our guest, Robin Mills. Robin is the CEO of Camar Energy, which he founded in 2015. He is an expert on energy strategy and fuel economics. He is a distinguished author and scholar who lives in the Middle East and is acknowledged by many as one of the region's leading figures on Middle Eastern energy matters. Robin, many thanks for talking with us today. Clearly, OPEC and OPEC Plus agreements to cut output from May and prospects of an economic recovery, albeit a slow one, now that some countries are allowing businesses to reopen, is clearly not enough to offset plummeting demand. How long, Robin, do you think demand will stay depressed? And do you buy this idea of a V-shaped recovery?
Yes, thank you, Axel. Hello, everyone. So I find the current optimism or even perhaps complacency over the markets and the progression of this virus really quite remarkable. Yes, I find these projections of a V-shaped recovery, an almost instant bounce back in both the economy and in oil demand, I find them very hard to see, I must say. We're still maybe in some places we're approaching the point of getting to containment of the first wave of the virus. That's about the best that we can say. Perhaps starting to see some places opening up again to a limited extent will, and hopefully that'll be sustainable. But I mean, there's always the danger, of course, that they won't be able to remain open and the virus will resurge. Some promising signs on a vaccine, but most medical opinion is that a vaccine is likely to be a long way off. And then I think even if we're able to contain the virus quite soon, we'll still be dealing with an enormous amount of economic fallout, changes in commuting habits, changes in travel patterns, and then an overhang of companies that have gone bankrupt and jobs that have been lost. And we must say that sadly, probably a lot of those jobs will not come back. And it will be a big struggle for European countries and the US and others to come out of that. And that all means, I think for me, lower oil demand in the longer term. Yeah. But of course, right now
Go ahead, Robin.
So I mean, right now, of course, we're living in the short term, and we're dealing with perhaps 30 million barrels per day of lost demand in April, perhaps a little bit less in May, perhaps only 28 million barrels per day lost in the face of an OPEC production cut, if it's fully implemented from May. Of about 7.5 million barrels per day on the levels from the start of the year, so it's something. But to be honest, it's not much more than a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, and I guess based on those numbers you've just mentioned, it's basic maths. If the demand drops 30 million a day, the cuts are 10, the prices stay under pressure. How long do you think they will stay under pressure for? And is there anything stopping WTI hitting zero again, given the lack of storage?
Well, I think, you know, we haven't even seen the probably the worst of the pressure on the oil price yet, because we still haven't reached this this kind of semi-mythical point of full storage, which we seem to be hurtling towards. Now, of course, storage like never gets actually full, but we can get to a point that it's practically full, and it's practically full in the key locations, like the US, like Cushing, like parts of Northwestern Europe, like Korea, China, and so on. So get to the point where there's no space to put oil where people really want to put it. And at that point, prices can get driven down much further, to the point that producers just have to leave the market. They can't sell their oil. They can't store it. So they have to shut down production. And we're actually already getting into that phase in the US. Whether WTI goes negative again for this coming month, you noted at the start that it's already under pressure. I think, again, it'll be under a lot of pressure towards the end of the month. Now, whether the traders are perhaps there's some less naive investors in WTI this month around, and they've realized that, oh, yes, it can go negative. So people will, I think, be less inclined to risk the exposure and will try and get out earlier. Mm. And perhaps they'll, you know, the people who stay in it long term will be those who are capable of taking delivery. So perhaps it won't go negative, but all clearly right. it's going to come under a lot of pressure yet again, because, as we say, storage is getting pretty full.
When do you think it will run out, storage? I mean, you say we can't really ever reach full storage. In fact, it's worth mentioning here this a Reuters story I saw today detailing how oil traders are hiring expensive U.S. vessels, I think known as the Jones Act vessels, to store gasoline. Goldman Sachs saying, I think, 3 weeks from now. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, really, people are scouring the world for storage. And, you know, normal times, people run a mile from a Jones Act vessel, which, you know, a U.S. Built, a U.S. crewed, U.S. registered vessel, which is very expensive. But now, of course, they're looking for anything going. And that's why storage won't completely run out. But what will happen is that prices get depressed so much that production has to be shut in. And we already see this, you know, production storage has already reached the level of being effectively full in parts of the onshore US because marketers are offering negative prices to oil producers just to say, we can't take your oil. Now, maybe if you pay us something, we can try and take it off your hands.
Do you, something else that came out today, Russia's energy minister saying he expects markets to start balancing out once the output deal takes effect. Do you think, and what does that mean, balancing out? Do you think that's a little bit too optimistic?
Well, I think there's a point of balance at which supply and demand come into rough equilibrium. And of course, OPEC Plus group cutting helps that. But as I say, you know, still you've got 7.5 million of cuts encountering 30 million of lost demand. And okay, even if demand is recovering, let's say into May, June, and so on, it's still going to be a dramatic recovery before we get to the point that we're not building stocks anymore. So yeah, that's where we've got to get to being balanced. And balance doesn't mean a high oil price. You know, I think this market will balance at a pretty low oil price until there's a substantial rebound in demand.
Just shifting focus a little bit, what's the future for U.S. shale and the oil producers there? Is there a chance quite a few of these could go broke?
Yes, I think that the outlook is extremely tough. So, you know, if you heard Scott Sheffield, he's runs Pioneer, it's one of the large shale companies. And he's been saying that there are something like 78 listed U.S. shale producers. You know, he expects that within a year or so, that will be down to 10. So he's expecting an enormous number of bankruptcies and consolidations to leave us with just a few, presumably much more solid shale companies. And we'll see the majors, Exxon, Chevron, and others, picking up shale assets. But I think we'll see a much, much smaller shale industry. We'll see production decline dramatically. So U.S. shale production drops perhaps 250,000 barrels a day each month without reinvestment. And of course, investment now at the moment is dropping sharply, and you would expect if prices are at these levels, we'll go to close to zero over the next few months. And then that's how production would decline if there's no new investment. On top of that is that wells actually being actively closed down because there's no storage or because they can't cover their operating costs. Mm-hmm. So, okay, and yes, if prices recover, those wells can be reopened and will produce again in the future. But still in the short term, we expect most of the bulk of the adjustment in the market that isn't taken by OPEC Plus, the bulk of that to be made by US shale producers.
Sure. And same sort of thing for Canada. Canada's promised significant cuts. What about the tar sands? Are they doomed?
Again, it's a very difficult time for Canada. You know, Canada's a more or less landlocked producer, of course, sends most of its oil into the US, where, of course, it's now not finding a market or storage. Oil sands operating costs are high, and you know, don't justify. I think most of the oil sands producers would be running at negative margins already. They just don't shut in production now because stopping production is expensive, and there's a concern about how easily they can restart it. You know, they're injecting steam into the ground, and as part of the process of recovering the oil, once you stop that and the oil goes solid, it's a very difficult process to start it up again. You know, and it's a bit of a game of chicken. You know, all the oil sands guys wait and hope that it'll be the other guy who shuts in first. But in the end, of course, several will be forced to, and several of them have already cut production by some degree.
I'll come back to the big picture, the big picture oil, before we finish, Robin. But I want to pick your brain a little bit on LNG and the gas picture. I mentioned LNG prices also still very much under pressure. What do you think key producers can expect to see near term? And I guess the big question, and I've heard this from a number of people, in light of oil prices trading negative last week, can LNG trade negative?
Yeah, I mean, the current environment, we're all ready to think the unthinkable. I mean, the LNG industry is also in a tough position, and it was in a tough position last year, to be honest, even before the virus outbreak, because there was already a big oversupply. But this year we've seen Asian spot prices going below $2. That's unheard of. And in fact, Asian spot prices and European prices are below US prices. Again, that's an incredible turnaround from the last 10 years when US onshore natural gas was the cheapest in the world. So now you've got a lot of US LNG producers who are faced with the issue of buying now what is relatively costly gas off the grid and trying to liquefy it and send it to Europe or Asia to get a lower price. Mm. I mean, obviously that makes no sense at all. They continue because they have contractual commitments. But again, of course, that they won't keep that up forever. And so I think, you know, the question of will LNG go negative? Probably not, because before that, the US producers and others, you know, we've seen Egypt cutting back. We'll see other countries just cutting back on their LNG production because it simply isn't worth it.
I mean, you mentioned, Robin, the US projects. I mean, you know, I wonder here in this context what this means for the Qatar LNG projects, and the fact that the US is suffering. I presumably that's relatively good news, but demand is weak in Japan. Demand is weak in China. What do you think specifically for Qatar?
Yeah, so Qatar, of course, has got these huge expansion projects underway. They would enter the market, if they go ahead with a reasonable time period, they'd enter the market between 2024, 2027, within that time period. People expected the market, there'd be a market window, there'd be more market demand at that time. Now, I think a lot of the US projects and other major projects, future projects, are not going to go ahead now, or certainly not, probably not for a long time. So this in a sense, that's positive for Qatar as the one country that's really committed now to having projects in that time window. Obviously we have to very much look for what's future demand going to be like. That depends on the recovery of the world economy. Mm-hmm. But I think if LNG prices are as low as they are now, or at least low-ish for the next few years, we'll also see a lot of demand. You know, it's now again, another unprecedented thing. It's now cheaper to burn gas in much of Asia than it is to burn coal. And of course, coal is also a dirty fuel. So, you know, I think we could see a lot of new demand being created over the next few years.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to. I'm keeping a wary eye on the time, and I don't want to get too technical here. But one thing I did want to mention, this is another Reuters story I saw, that hedge funds have been pretty heavy buyers last week of WTI. You know, seems they are positioning for some kind of future rally. There seems to be a focus on NYMEX, on IC, WTI, the buying in Brent a little bit. Smaller. What does that tell you about where you think we might be going on this price? And let me just throw this out there. Do you think we'll ever see 2019 levels again?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's a remarkable amount of buoyancy in the stock markets at the moment. You know, you would think this was a desperately bad economic situation, which it is. And yet there's been quite a bounce back in the stock markets. And I think, you know, we see this in oil as well. You know, some funds that do see an opportunity in the slightly longer term and think that we've hit the bottom. And of course, there's others who are playing strategies with time spreads and so on. So that, you know, that has increased the amount of interest. As we suggested at the start of the program, I'm not nearly as optimistic that we've hit the bottom or that we're going to see a rapid recovery. But as far as demand goes, you know, there's an enormous amount of demand will be wiped out this year. How much oil demand will come back? Will we ever get back to the 2019 levels of demand? My own feeling is that yes, we will, but that we are going to see a substantial amount of demand that is destroyed permanently and a somewhat slow recovery in demand, because I think, firstly, the world economy will have suffered a great shock, and there'll be a lot of fallout from that. And secondly, a lot of companies will say, do we really need people to commute to the office every single day? We've tried home working. It was fine, and it's cheaper and easier. You know, why don't people work at home half the day, half the week? Do we need to send people flying around the world all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're saying, though, this is not peak oil demand now?
I don't think so. No, I think given a few years, I think we will bounce back and we'll probably surpass the 2019 level. But I think it does mean that peak oil demand will be sooner than we would have thought. Mm. You know, we were thinking previously in the mid 2030s. Perhaps it's brought that forward to 2030 or the late 2020s, and it'll be at a lower level than we were thinking.
All right, Robin. One final question. Clearly, this is a challenge for the Gulf nations. A number of nations, oil-producing countries, trying to balance their fiscal budgets at times. Just how, I guess, from a political standpoint here, we've talked about the equity markets, talked about oil prices. I've just thrown in balancing budgets. So politically, how challenging could this become?
Well, it is a huge challenge for every major oil and gas exporter, for sure. Now, some of them are, their economies are in, entered this in a stronger position, and they have large sovereign wealth funds, and the budget to break even price and their current account balance, so their trade balance was not requiring too high oil prices. So they'll come through this. Yes, it won't be comfortable. They'll have to sell assets and raise debt and so on, but they can survive. For some other countries that don't really have much buffers, and that also are in situations of political crisis and conflict already, it's extremely damaging. And obviously, you look at a country like Iraq, which is very exposed, big budgetary commitments that are hard to cut, not much, already substantial debt, not much capacity to borrow more, and in the middle of a political crisis, the third prime ministerial candidate still trying to form a government. So, yeah, a place like Iraq is in big trouble. Mm. And obviously, you know, we can look at some other countries around the world that also have big political and economic problems and wonder how do they come through this. So it is an extremely unsettling time.
Robin, I am going to stop us there. Many thanks to you for your insights today. Robin Mills, the CEO of Camar Energy. Do watch this space. As I said, this is the first in a series of podcasts from the Alatia Foundation. The next one is planned for sometime in early May. Many thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Axel Throvel from Reuters.